Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Chav Dalet Amud Bet, two lines from the bottom. Gemara is discussing here the statement that the Gemara makes, which is actually associated with all the different nidarim that are mentioned in the Mishnayot. What is the ramifications, the Gabe Shbuot? So our Mishnah here is discussing Nidre Havai. So our Gemara had a statement, Tana Nidre Havai Mutarim, Shbuot Havai Asurim, which is one girsa, the alternate girsa, which is brought by the Ran, by the Rambam, and is also in the Tosefta, is the Tano Nidre Havai Mutarim, Shvuot Havai Mutarim, that they're also both Mutar. So we discuss then, the Gemara wants to know what type of Shvuah are we speaking about. And then you have the suggestion of Abaye, and then we left off with the suggestion of Rova, which is, it's parallel to what the Nether is in our Mishnah, Be'umer, Yasru Perot Olam Alai, Bishvuah, Im lo ra'iti b'derech hazeh kolei Mitzrayim. If I didn't see on this way kolei Mitzrayim, then obviously depending on whether you think shvuot are mutarin or shvuot are serin, you'll explain rova in that manner. And now we have a question. Amalei Ravino the Ravashi, v'dilma hai gavro. Maybe this individual kino deshum shemane chaza. Maybe this guy saw basically an ant hill, a big area. Kino is usually a nest. But over here we're talking about an ant, so it's an anthill or an ant house. But Asik Lon Shma Ole Mitzrayim. And he gave them the name Ole Mitzrayim, Vishaper Mishtabo. And therefore his Shvuah is totally fine. Because he's referencing these ants. These ants, there's so many of them that he calls them Kole Mitzrayim. And that's what he's taking the Shvuah about, is this group of ants that he calls Ole Mitzrayim. So maybe there's no problem with his Shvuah. Now, according to those who say that it's Asur, that Shvuot Havai or Asurin, the suggestion being here that it would be Mutar. According to those that said Shvuot Havai or Mutarim, over here we're talking about the possibility that he shouldn't be Chayav for Shvuot Shav. Because even if you believe that Shvuot Havai or Mutarim, that's the Gabay, the issue of Shvuot Sheker, but still there might be an issue of Shvuot Shav. So in that instance, this would get rid of that problem of Shvuah Shav. So they have a Shapir Mishtabel, and therefore he's taking a fine Shvuah. So Amalei Ki Mishtabel, Adaita Didan Mishtabel. That when a person takes a Shvuah, he does it based on what normal people would do, as Rashi says, Kederach Shebnei Adam Nishbaim. That we have to assume that he's speaking in a manner that is common language to everyone that's there. Vanan lo maskinan nafshin ashum shemane, and we would never have in mind a bunch of ants as being ole Mitzrayim. So if that's not a natural or easy understanding that would come through the words of ole Mitzrayim, then we're not going to assume that that's what he has in mind. So now the Gemara here makes an assumption that what the person is thinking is not relevant to the nether or the shvuah. Now we already saw earlier, we had a Mishnah that said by the individual who says that I took a neder shvuah b'cherem, that he can say that it meant chermel shel yam. So over there also, that seems to be an interpretation which is not the mainstream interpretation of the word, and yet there we grant him the right to make such an interpretation. How come over here he doesn't have that right to make the interpretation? So the Ran over here distinguishes between Davar muflag, or something that is plausible or palatable. Then an explanation, even though it may not be the first thing that would come to mind, but if it's something that is not ridiculous in explaining it, that will accept as an explanation for something in the nether, like chamo shel yam. So it might not be your first thought, but it's also not completely ridiculous to assume that cherem refers to chamo shel yam. On the other hand, when you talk about ole Mitzrayim, to assume that it's talking about ants, that's something that's completely far-fetched. It's not anything that would come to mind. No matter how many times you told somebody something like this, it would not be the first thing that comes to mind. And therefore, it's deemed to be a davar muflag. And that's how the Rosh here differentiates between the cases by saying, how reasonable is the assumption of the individual? Even if it is not the most common understanding explanation of the word, if it's at least reasonable, we'll accept it. But over here, where this is completely unreasonable, then we won't accept that type of explanation. So that's the way the Rosh differentiates between them. Others suggest, which makes a lot of sense, there's a difference in the nether there versus the nether over here. The nether over there is an individual taking a nether to be oser something on himself. The neder is only vis-a-vis himself, and then his explanation or his dvarim shebelev there matter because the interpretation of the neder is only relevant to him. And so therefore, whatever he had in mind, we can accept because it's affecting him and no one else. But over here, where you're taking a shvua towards others, or you're trying to substantiate information, then that takes on a different color, because now you're talking about taking a shvua or a neder vis-a-vis someone else, and then their understanding also becomes important. So then we go to this common denominator, which is, what would normal people think in this instance? That's another way to differentiate between the two cases over here, as to why over here we're demanding that it be something that is mainstream, whereas over there we give you a lot more latitude in terms of the understanding of what you said. Is that really true that people don't have in mind some personal interpretation when they take a shvua? Vatanya, don't we have a braita? Kishain mashbi'in oto, when they ask the individual to take a shvua, omrim lo, have a yodea. We're not accepting this shvua based on whatever conditions or thoughts that you have in your heart. Ela aldatenu, valdat beitin, it's probably aldat hamakom, valdat beitin, it's probably the right lashon. We'll see the similar lashon come up in the Gemara. But rather, the shvua that you're about to take is governed by Hashem and the beitin. Whatever they are thinking, whatever they are assuming would be the normal explanation of this shvua, that will be determinant here, and not what you're thinking, and not what's in your heart. So first of all, it's clear here that they're saying this individual, because they do worry about the alternative, which is that someone would take a shvua al datam. And the Gemara wants to know, lafu kemai, what does that come to exclude? Where is there a case where a person's personal explanation of his shvua matters? Isn't it a case where these iskundere are interpreted being different things? Loosely, they are either dice, or they are like poker chips. They are little cubes for games, or little shards that go into a game, game pieces. Vasiklahon shma zuze. And he calls his dice, his lucky dice, his chips, he calls them zuze. And then, made the kamaral datenu, the fact that Beitin in this instance forces him to say, or forces him to acknowledge that the shvua is not based on what he's thinking, but rather on what Beitin assumes he is saying. From there you would conclude that people, when they do take shvuot, would make their own interpretation, or their own interpretation is important to the shvua. So this guy over here is going to come to Beitin. He owes money, or he is talking about money. So he named his lucky dice Zuze. And then when he takes the shvua, he's going to be referencing to those chips, poker chips, or those dice, and not to real money that he owes. And therefore, Beitin says to him, listen, you're not going to be able to take a shvua like that, because over here we're binding you to the understanding of Beitin and the understanding that Hashem would have in this situation. You can't have your own personal take on this shvua. But that means that in other situations where you don't make such a declaration, it's possible that the individual would have such a personal interpretation of his shvua. So Rashi says, well, that's not what it comes to exclude. It's not that you can have these personal interpretations of the shvua, but rather, afuke mikanyu derovo. It comes to exclude the case of the cane of rovo. Dao gavro dabim masik v'chavrei zuzei. It was this individual as a creditor to his friend. After the kamei derovo, the creditor comes to Rava. Amalei lelove zilparali. Says to the debtor, I want to be paid. You haven't paid me back yet. Amalei piraticha. He says, I already paid you back in full. So amalei rovo, imkein, zil ishtabali, diparate. Go take a shvua that you paid him back. Azal va'aiti kanyo. He went ahead and took a cane. In the hollow part of the cane, he stuck the money into the cane. So he was using it to lean on. He was relying on the cane, and he brought it with him to Beitin. He said to the Malve, take my cane. Can you hold on to it for me while I take the Shvua? Nasav Sefer Torah. He grabbed the Sefer Torah. Vishtaba depare kol madahavale biyodei. He says to him that I paid you back everything that you have in your hand. Now, the Ran over here says the girsa should not be parate because he didn't pay him back with the intent of paying him the money to be back. So rather the girsa over here should be vishtaba dahavet lachazuzcha. I gave you your money. Kol havale biyodei. It's in your hand. All the money is in your hand right now. So now, first of all, there's some interesting parts of this. The fact that he took a Sefer Torah to take a Shavuah is subject to a machloket in the Gemara and Shavuot. Rashi over there notes such a difference that's based on the Shita of the Gaonim as to whether, when it comes to a Shavuah d'Oraita versus a Shavuah d'Rabbanan, do we say that by a Shavuah d'Oraita you have Nikitat Chayfetz, which is that you take a Dvar Mitzvah or a Dabar Shebik Dusha and you hold it in your hands, whether it's a Sefer Torah, whether it's Tefillin, something that's sort of when you take the Shavuah, not that it changes the Shavuah is B'Shem Hashem, that's what makes the difference, but it's just to increase the intensity of the Shavuah. When a person's holding a Sefer Torah, when a person is holding Tefillin, they understand that this is much more serious and that the ramifications are much more severe when you take a Shavuah of this nature. So the Gaonim believe that there was such a distinction between a Shavuah d'Oraita versus a Shavuah d'Rabbanan. And therefore, only if you were taking a Shavuah d'Oraita, do you have Nikitat Chepetz. So now, the Ran, based on that, says that it must be here that we're talking about a Shavuah d'Oraita. Over here, he denied the entire claim. That's a Kofar Bakol. Kofar Kol in the Torah does not take a Shavuah. There is a Shavuah d'Rabbanan, probably introduced at the time of Rav Nachman of Shavuah Heset. That's a Shavuah d'Rabbanan. Therefore, the Ran concludes, it must be here that he was Modeh B'Miktzat. And since he was Modeh B'Miktzat, we're talking about a Shavuah d'Oraita. That's what he's picking up as Sefer Torah. On the other hand, the Balei HaTosafot, who believe that there is no distinction between a Shavuah d'Oraita, Shavuah d'Rabbanan, a Shavuah Beit Din, you have Nikitat Chepetz. It's nothing to do with d'Oraita d'Rabbanan. See this as a proof to their position. Because seemingly over here, he's taking a Shavuah Heset, and he picks up a Sefer Torah. So that would prove or indicate the fact that one does take a chefet shel kedusha when they take a shavuah d'rabbanan. So they see this as a proof to their position. The last possibility is that this is all part of the ruse. This guy is trying to fool the other guy. So as part of his charade, he picks up a sefer Torah to take the shavuah to make it look like this guy is taking a serious shavuah. Not that it was necessary, but he voluntarily took the sefer Torah in order to make it look like he's really taking the shavuah. So then, how malva Rogoz, he got so angry because he knew the guy was lying to his face. V'tavra la'u kanyan, he smashes the cane on the ground. V'shtapa chanuzuzei la'aro, and all of a sudden all this money came pouring out of the cane. V'shtakach tekushta ishtaba, and the fact was his shwa was truthful, that he did not lie at all, because the guy was holding all the money in his hands at that time. So now what the suggestion is that the reason Beit Din goes ahead and demands that it'll be al dat makom al dat beitin is because of this type of charade or these charlatans that come in and are taking shvuot that are true by playing games and putting the money on the guy's hand through the cane. So that's what it's coming to exclude. It's not coming to say that you can make up the interpretation of the shvuah. It's simply to prevent a case in which the guy is telling the truth and everything is truthful, but because of the backhanded way in which he dealt with it, he's able to tell the truth, even though he hasn't paid the guy back. So that's what it's coming to prevent. Says, is it really still true that people do not have a personal twist on their shvuah? Vatanya, don't we have a brayta v'chein matzinu b'Moshe Rabbeinu that we find by Moshe Rabbeinu when he forces Bnei Israel to take a shvuah at the end of Sefer Dvarim, at the end of his life? Kishbiat Israel barvot Moav, when he has Bnei Israel enter into the covenant in Arvot Moav, Amar lehem, if you do him, shlo adatchem ani mashbiatchem. You should know that when you take this shvuah now, it's not based on your interpretation. El adati v'adat hamakom, based on what I'm thinking and what Hashem is thinking. So that's why the girsa above is also probably al datenu v'adat hamakom, similar to the way that it is over here, al dati v'adat hamakom. Shinemar, as the pasuk says, "Velo yitchem levadchem." Okay, so Rashi learns from this that that is the source for the fact which is lo yitchen levadchem. It's not just what you're thinking, even though the pashtut, the pasuk is lo yitchen levadchem, not only you, but others. So that's one way to interpret it, why the shvua that has been taken here, the covenant that they're entering into, is not based on their own thought, piyasis. Or it's from the words, anochi koreit, that I am establishing a covenant with you. This is also lifnei Hashem. So those are words that indicate that the shvua is governed by Moshe and Hashem. Shalmi suggested because it includes not only people that are here today, but even people are sharing enu imanu poayom. Even people that are not present. Well, the people who aren't present can't have any personal twist on the Shua because they're not here. And therefore, the Yerushalmi says that's the source for the fact that it's based on what Moshe and Hashem are thinking. So those are words that indicate that the Shua is governed by Moshe and Hashem. So you have different thoughts as to what the exact source is. But either way, you have here now a Midrash Halacha telling you that this covenant was entered into in a way that demanded a conformance in terms of the Shvua to Dat Moshe and Dat Hashem. The only reason you would have to do that is because there's a possibility that they would have thought otherwise. So that indicates that people do have the ability to take a Shvua with their own personal notes or twist on it. My Amar Lehu Moshe Yisrael. What does Moshe say to Bnei Yisrael? Love Hachi Kamar Lehu. Isn't this what he's telling to them? Dilma. Maybe you are thinking over here. Dilma Vreitun Mile. Vamritun al datenu, that we are doing this based on what we're thinking. Mishimachi amarlo al dati. So they might be thinking, look, we're going to take this covenant and enter this covenant based on our interpretation. So Moshe comes to offset that and say, no, it's on my interpretation, not your interpretation. Lafuke mai, what does that come to exclude? Lafuke dasiku shma lovodat kochavim. Eloka. So it's a case where people decide to name Avodah Zarah Eloka, meaning God. And therefore, what you're suggesting is that the Shvua, the covenant they're entering into, is with this Avodah Zarah and not with Hashem. Because they call the Avodah Zarah Eloka, which is interesting. By the way, the word is an interesting word because it is found in Hallel. Today's Rosh Chodesh, so we say it in Hallel. But the word is pronounced Mila El, which is that the accent's on the lamed, but there's also a mapik hay with a patach under it, which has the sound of like it mameyah, which is the ah sound. So then the accent's on the lamed. So it's a very actually difficult word to pronounce because the focus is elo to make the hay pronounce at the end, which is a strong pronunciation, but the syllabization's on the lamed. Something as a side note, because we said elo today, keep in mind the difficulty of the pronunciation of the word. But anyway, they named the Avodah Zarah Eloka, and because of that, they basically are assuming that their Shvua is with the Avodah Zarah, not with Hashem. And Moshe comes to be Sholel to take away that possibility. Michlal, what would you conclude from this? Otherwise, had Moshe not said that, there would be a possibility that they were taking the Shvua based on their own interpretation. Lo, Avodah Kochavim Mikra Eloka Dichtiv. Now, the truth is that Avodah Zarah, that's not something that is far-fetched. To say Avodah Zarah is called Elokim, Dichtivu B'chol Elohei Mitzrayim, the gods of Mitzrayim. It's a problem in the Torah in general. The word Elohim in the Torah has multiple meanings. And it's also in plural. So most of the Rishonim, you can see the Ibn Ezra, the Ramban, discuss this issue that Elohim is plural, implying that there are multiple gods. So their explanation, or most explanations, is that the word Elohim means someone of power. God is Elokei Elohim. He is the God of gods, or God of all powers. He is the one who distributes the powers to these other constellations, stars, whatever it is that God distributes in order to work, but they're all working under God. But the word Elohim, therefore, means anything that we attribute a certain amount of stature or power to. So the word Elohim can be used to refer to Avodah Zarah, which is Elohei Mitzrayim. Elohim is used in the Torah to refer to Dayanim also. And then it's also used as Elohim to mean God. So the word is somewhat ambiguous in the Torah, and anytime you have the word in the Torah, you have to actually understand, context sometimes helps, but sometimes it's hard to know. For instance, in Breishit, when it says Bnei Elohim, is it Bnei Elohim or Bnei Elohim? Which makes a big difference in the interpretation of that pasuk. And that's the subject of the Midrash Agadata over there. of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai about anybody who calls them Bnei Elohim is mistaken. It's only it's Bnei Elohim. That they were the sons of the judges, the sons of the powerful people. But therefore, over here, it's not something that in their own interpretation of the Shvuah, they're saying, oh, the word Elohim means my Avodah Zarah. That's not a far-fetched explanation. That's what the Rosh would say. That's a reasonable explanation of the word, and therefore it could govern over here. Or you could just say, that's not an interpretation. That is what the word means. The word has all these different meanings to it. And therefore, that's not something where you're personalizing the interpretation. That's a very reasonable way to go. And that's why Moshe has to force them to say, it's al-dativ, al-data makom, that the word Elohim is being used here and not the word Elohim. And it might be, by the way, that the Torah intentionally uses the word as an interchangeable word. I don't have enough time to speak about it now, but the fact that a Dayan is called Elohim is important because we know that the Kerav Elohim Yishpot, that God is found in the place with the Dayanim. That when a person comes before the court, it's as if he's standing before God, it's as if the presence of Hashem is there. And therefore, they're being interchangeable is, in a sense, giving that message that the Dayan is acting like the Elohim, meaning that he's acting like Hashem in terms of he represents the Shekhinah there, but he's also Elohim, which is that he's a person of power now, and therefore he is governed both by the rules of Elohim, of God, but also the person coming to before the court also has to realize that. And so maybe the word is intentionally ambiguous because of that, because it represents, and many times it represents, even when it's used as Elohim, it also represents Elohim. So Gemara says, V'lishava yaton, de'kamitun mitzvot. So Gemara says, why don't he just have them take a shvua that they'll keep the mitzvot? So Gemara says, mitzvot, mashma mitzvot ha-melech. Right? So that would be a problem, because mitzvot, which just means commands, how do you know what the interpretation of the word commands is over here? Rashi suggests over here, Mashma mitzvah ha-melech shepashat som tasim alecha melech. Mitzvah ha-melech means the commands that are found in the parsha in Devarim that deals with the king. So the couple of mitzvot that deal with the king, maybe that's what the reference is to. Others, like the Rosh over here, quote the pasuk from Esther, which is Madu ata over al mitzvah ha-melech. Why do you not keep the command of the king? So the command of the king there would be in a secular sense that the decrees of the king. So how do you know what mitzvot you're referring to over here? V'lishbali yaton demekai mitun kol mitzvot. Why don't over there have him take a shvua that they'll keep all the mitzvot? Kol mitzvot is much more meaningful in terms of the mitzvot of Torah. It says, kol mitzvot mashma mitzvah tzitzit. That means they could be referring to the mitzvah tzitzit. Amar mar, shkula mitzvah tzitzit keneged kol mitzvot shebetorah. The mitzvah tzitzit is keneged kol mitzvot ha-Torah. We just read it, last week's parsha. Mitzvah tzitzit, which discusses uzchartem et kol mitzvot Hashem, that through seeing the tzitzit you remember all the mitzvot Hashem. And from that, Chazal say that the mitzvah tzitzit is keneged kol mitzvot shebetorah. So if you tell them that you're taking a shwa, a big call a mitzvot of Torah, the person might say, ah, tzitzit, I have to keep the mitzvot tzitzit, that's it. V'li shva, they are told to be kaimitun Torah. Why don't they just take a shwa that they'll keep the Torah? Mashma Torah chat. Because that would have the meaning of one Torah. Most of the Rishonim over here say that it means one Torah, which is that we have Torah shebichtav and Torah shebe'alpeh. And later on from the upcoming Gemara makes it sound that way, that the Torah that we're referencing over here means that you have a Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebalpeh. If I use the singular, then I haven't included both of them. So I say I'll keep the Torah Shebichtav, or only keep the Torah Shebalpeh, in that there's an ability to interpret that not to mean a binding agreement over both the Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebalpeh. Yishava yaton, demekayim yitun, torot. So why don't you say the word torot in plural? So the Gemara says, well, the word torot, mashma, torat mincha, torat chatat, torat tasham. So the word Torah in the Torah itself really means a set of instructions. That's what the word Torah means. And that's why those parshiot in Vayikra are called Torah Tachatat, Torah Tasham. These are the rules or the instructions that are associated with that Korban. So you could have argued before also, when he uses the word Torah, that it doesn't mean Torah Shebichtav or Torah Shebalpeh. You could have argued that means Torah just means one of the instructions of the Torah, the Torah Tanazir, the Torah Tasuta, the Torah Mincha, the Torah Chatat, where the Torah uses these terminology there, and you could have argued that it's one of those. So let's learn it in plural. Well, if you do it in plural, you still don't help yourself out, because it can reference multiple mitzvot. Torat HaMincha, Torat HaChatat, Torat HaSham. So Lishava Yaton, Demekai Mitun, Torot, O Mitzvot. So there we say, all right, then do Torot in plural, and mitzvot in plural. Umar says, no, Torot Mashma, Torat Mincha, Mitzvot Mashma, Mitzvot HaMelech. You can still parse each word separately and say that the Torot refer to Torat HaMincha and Torat HaChatat, and the mitzvot refer to the mitzvot HaMelech. Lishava Yaton, Demekai Mitun, Torah Kula. So why don't we say that you have to keep the Torah, the entire Torah? Now there's no doubt about what he's speaking about, the entirety of the Torah. That's not referencing a single instruction or a single group of mitzvot. Torah kula means the entirety of the instructions. What are the entirety of the instructions? That means Torah kula. So Torah kula, mashma avodat kochovim, also from last week's parsha. The Torah sounds like avodah zarah. Why? Tanya, chamura avodat kochovim. Avodat kochovim is such a severe abrogation of the laws of the Torah. Shakola koferba, kilu modeh b'Torah kula. Anybody who denies avodah zarah and believes in Hashem is as if he's kept the kol Torah kula. Because in last week's parsha, when it talks about the korban for avodah zarah, over there it says kol mitzvot. It says all of the mitzvot. So it makes the avodah zarah shkula keneged kol ha mitzvot. Which is interesting in of itself, because in last week's parsha, Parshat Shlach, the end of the parsha, we have mitzvah tzitzit, which is keneged kol haturah kula. You have the mitzvah avodah zarah, which is the shigigat avodah zarah, which is also keneged kol haturah kula. And the parsha finishes off with the mikoshei sheitzim, which is a din of Shabbat, which is also something that Chazal say about Shabbat, is keneged kol haturah kula. And therefore, a person's status is determined as to whether they are Shomer Shabbat or not. And what's the other theme that is brought in the Parsha is about Eretz Yisrael. The implications meaning that maybe that Eretz Yisrael fits into those mitzvot of Tzitzit, Avodah Zarah, Shabbat, and that it may be connected Kol HaTorah Kula also, that there is a certain level, or we put it on these in the same Parsha, in the same theme as these other mitzvot, which are connected Kol HaTorah Kula. Right, the Ramban, definitely at the end of Sefer Vayikra, his Perush on Bechukotai, says that very clearly, that it is connected kol mitzvot, and he upholds what's famous in Rashi, which is that keeping the mitzvot in Chutz Laretz is just practice, and where the Ramban says that's for sure, that it's definitely practice, it's practice, and it's not the real thing until you get to Eretz Yisrael. So definitely, conceptually, there is this idea that Eretz Yisrael has that status of being connected kol Torah kula. So the shava ba'on the mekayim etun avodat kachavim v'Torah kula. So we can be sholel that possibility by saying he should keep avodah zarah and Torah kula. So now obviously the meaning of Torah kula is not avodah zarah anymore, because you specify avodat kachavim separately or independently. Inami. Otherwise you could just say sheish meot v'shlosh esrei mitzvot, that they should keep the 613 mitzvot. By the way, this is one of the rarer occasions where the Gemara actually spells out that there are 613 mitzvot, which plagued all the Monea mitzvot. How do we get to the 613? The number does not appear so frequently in the Chazal. Here's one of the locations where Chazal clearly lists out that there are 613 mitzvot, which is why all the Monea mitzvot are trying to get to this number of 613 tayag mitzvot. So here the Gemara has suggestions where we could solve the problem, which is Moshe Rabbeinu could have just said Avodah Zarah plus Torah Kula, or he could have said keep the 613 commandments. Ella Moshe Rabbeinu milta de lo tricha nakot. He just did the simple thing. He didn't have to spell it all out. All he has to say is Adativ, Adata Makom, and that finishes all these other possibilities out. He doesn't have to think through all the different permutations and what people are going to think. This way, if he just says Adativ, Adata Makom, he shuts down any other possibility. Now, that means that we can't infer anything from this, which is that we can't prove from this that normally a shvua would be subject to a personal interpretation, and therefore it's not so clear that one can have a personal interpretation to a shvua, at least from this proof, as well as the proof before by Beit Din, because we found reasons that they would have to do this to lafuke, to exclude cases where there's an interpretation of the shvua that is actually true or reasonable, And that's what it's coming to exclude, not to exclude a case where the person makes a personal twist on the Shavuah, which is far-fetched. We're not saying from these two scenarios where either Beit Din makes him take a Shavuah al Datenu v'adat ha-makom, or Moshe Rabbeinu does al Dati v'adat ha-makom. It's not coming to exclude that case, and therefore we can't prove anything from this, that a person is able to have a personal twist in his Shavuah. The Gemara in Shavuot itself actually continues on and says that the reason Moshe Rabbeinu did it this way is not because it was easier, but rather so that there would be no hafara, that there would be no nullification of the covenant. Because if he does it, what's called al-dat rabim, that he took the Shavuah, the covenant, with the participation of everyone that's there, that makes it into a Shavuah al-dat rabim. If you make a Shavuah al-dat rabim, then it doesn't have hafara, which is that the covenant cannot be breached or cannot be nullified in any way. You can't get a hatara for the covenant. And that's why it was important to Rabbi Moshe Rabbeinu to say al-dati v'al-dat ha-makom, to make it into a al-dat rabim. Even though generally al-dat rabim requires three individuals or three dayanim, either because over here Hashem was involved, which is al-dat ha-makom, if you use Hashem, then that's automatically ein hafara because Hashem's involved in the covenant, and that's the equivalent of al-dat rabim. Or you have to say that because all of Rabbi Yisrael were present there, and Moshe Rabbeinu and others there, that it really was in the presence of three dayanim, or the fact that it was such a public event. And that maybe you need three dayanim when you're talking to a specific individual. But when you talk to Am Yisrael Kulo, maybe that's sufficient to make the covenant al-dat rabim, because the entirety of Klal Yisrael is there. So whatever those reasons, the Gemara in Shavuot ends off that was Moshe Rabbeinu's purpose in saying al-dativa dat ha-makom, not to deal with this issue of personalized Shavuot, but rather to deal with the issue of he wanted al-dat rabim, so there would not be any hafara. Now the truth is that if Moshe Rabbeinu was so worried about them violating Avodah Zarah or not following the covenant, why isn't he worried about the fact that they'll violate the Shavuah? Even if he makes it into a full-fledged Shavuah, why doesn't he worry about that fact? So the Marsha actually asked the question on here. I'm going to defer the discussion of that till the next series of Mishnayot, where we talk about Nidrei Anasin, because over there we'll see that phenomenon that people take the issue of Shavuot more seriously than other mitzvot. All right, so now we go back to the Mishnah. Remember in the Mishnah gave two examples of Nidrei Havai. The first one was that I saw Kolei Mitzrayim, and the second one says that I saw Nachash Kikorat Beit Abad. The Balei HaTosafot and many of the other Rishonim believe that those were two examples of exaggerations. They're both true, but they simply are exaggerations of the truth, but that's the way that people speak. People who say, there were thousands of people, millions of people there, even though they know for sure there weren't millions of people, which just means a lot of people, right? I saw something that you can't believe the size of what I saw. It was big as an elephant. Of course it wasn't the size of an elephant, just an expression that tells you that it was very large. So that's what these expressions are. On the other hand, the Ran believes that these were two types of nidarim. The first nidar was an exaggeration that was truthful. The second one was complete sheker, which is that there is no such thing as a snake, kikorat beit abad. It doesn't exist. And the person saying something that is completely untrue, and that's why the nether doesn't take effect. Because he didn't speak the truth, the nether doesn't take effect, because it's clear he doesn't want the nether to go into effect, because he's lying in the stipulation that he saw a snake that was kikorat beit abad. So now the Gemara asks about this snake that's the size of kikorat beit abad. Imel reiti nachash kikorat beit abad, v'lo, there isn't such a thing. There was this snake in the time of the Persian king Shavar Malka. Ramulei Tlesar. Now, our gears over here is Orvata de Tivna. The normal interpretation of Orvata are stables. So it would be they fed him 13 stables full of grain. Ubala Yaton, and he swallowed them all up. And that's the size of the snake, I mean the magnitude of the snake that he swallowed. 13 stables worth of grain, he's a pretty sizable snake. Rashi's interpretation, or Vata over here, are itzlabaot mleot teven, which are troughs full of grain. Whereas there was an alternate girsa that's brought by the Aruch, that would mean there is an alternate girsa, which is brought by the Aruch, which is adraita, and that adraita would mean orot, would mean skins. So therefore you would have the skins that were filled with grain. So they were like sacks of grain rather than stables of grain. So that would be something more reasonable, less of an exaggeration. It would make more sense than the interpretation that we're talking about these sacks or bags of grain. Be that as may, whatever the interpretation is, he ate a significant amount. This is a sizable snake, and it does reach the size of Korat Beit Abad. So why, first of all, why are we calling this Sheker according to the Ran? According to the Balei Tosfot, why is this Havai? Why is this an exaggeration? You could see a snake that size. It's not impossible. Amar Shmuel b'taruf. It says it's a case where it's taruf. Now, what does taruf mean? That is subject to machloket. Rashi says it's a nachash minumar. It's a spotted or striped snake. That's one possibility. The Ran over here says asui bikaim bikaim. It has, we call it crevices or cracks on it. And the last possibility is brought down by the Rosh, that it's a snake that is rachav veinu agul. It's wide and not circular. That it has a more of a squared out shape to it. The Yerushalmi actually says miruba, that it's a square. The Gemara says, kul nachashe mitraf tarfe. So wait a minute. The Gemara says, all snakes look like this. So either way, all snakes are, according to Rashi, striped or spotted. According to the Ran, that means that they all have these crevices or cracks on them. And according to the Rosh, that means that they're all wide and squared out. Where it says, agabo taruf kamrinan. We're talking about on its back, which means that on the flat belly of the snake, that's something that is common for the belly of the snake to be flat and squared out. The back of the snake, which either means the upper side of the snake or the neck of the snake, that is less likely to be squared out. And that's what we're referring to here. Or it's talking about a case where when we talk about minumar, it's spotted, they're cracked. That's more likely when you're talking about the belly, the flat end or the bottom end of the snake. That's less true when you're talking about the other side of the snake, the back of the snake. And therefore, the difference here is that this is something that is very unusual, and probably, according to the Ran, not true, never happened. Or according to the Balei Tosafot, it's something that's a big exaggeration because it's so unlikely. And the Yerushalmi says it's Meruba, again, it's something that is far-fetched or impossible, which is that you have a square snake. Snakes are rounded at some point in their body. So Gemara says, Vilitne taruf. So then, why doesn't he just say that it's taruf? Milta gavorche kamashmalon. The Mishnah is teaching us as a sidebar, another piece of information. To korot beit abad gabo taruf. That when it comes to the beams of the olive press, the large beam of the olive press, that it is also taruf. So again, all these explanations, whether it means that it has crevices or cracks in it, or does it mean that it is striped or spotted in some way, or does it mean that it's square? Right, all of those would be true here. So l'may nafkamina, why do we care that the Korat Beit Abad looks this way? L'mekach u'memkar, that's for transactions. L'mar l'cha mocher Korat Beit Abad, the chaveiro, someone who sells a beam to be utilized in the olive press, igabo taruf in ilo lo. If the backside, if the beam has these features to it, then it is a Korat Beit Abad. If it does not have these features to it, then it's not a Korat Beit Habad. So that's the side information that we get from the fact that the Mishnah termed Taruf as being the Korat Beit Habad. And that that is a synonym for Taruf is Korat Beit Habad. And from that we also learn out the properties not only of the snake, but the properties of the Korat Beit Habad. We continue here with the next set of Nidarim. You remember that the Mishnah at the beginning of the parak started out that there are four types of nidarim that are considered not to be nidarim and you don't need shelat chacham. So we've done so far two of those. One is nidrei ziruzim. The second one was nidrei havai. And now the third one is nidrei shkagot. These are nidarim that are taken by mistake. Now shkaga and the last category, which is nidrei anasim, is also in a similar vein, which is that there are two types of shkagar, two types of onus that can manifest. One is at the time of the neder itself, the person was mistaken. So it could be a shogeg or an onus in that case. Or there can be a shogeg or an onus at the time of the effectuation of the neder, which is if a person premises the neder on some sort of trigger, what is the trigger, a person could be a shogeg at the time of the trigger and not remember the neder, or he could be an onus that he is unable, like we saw in yesterday's daf, unable to accomplish the neder because of some unforeseen circumstance. So in that case, the neder doesn't go through. So the Mishnah here is going to give us examples that are of both types of categories. Categories where the nether, at the time it was taken, there was a mistake. The second category is that it's a nether that was taken, but then when you're trying to effectuate the nether, there's a mistake. And then there is actually a third case over here, which is at the time of the nether, that you met the nether and it was a fully good nether, but the information that you had or that caused you to take the nether was incorrect, and that you have to adjust the nether for those facts. So that's a maybe, possibly a third category. We'll see at the end of the Mishnah. So the first case is Nidre Shkagot. Im achalti v'im shatiti. V'niskar shachal v'shata. Person's taken nether. So here he's saying about the past tense, which is that I did eat, or I didn't eat, or I did drink, or I didn't drink. So he's trying to take a nether that substantiates information in the past. So when he took the nether, he completely forgot about the fact that he had eaten or he had drank at the time. And therefore, he takes the nether on a mistaken assumption. Then, v'niska shachal v'shata. And then he remembers that he really did eat or drink. The nether is null and void because he did a bit shogeg. He did it, was unintentional. Now over here, you have to separate. Truthfully, every nidre shogeg is very similar to a nidre ones. So you have to come up with some differentiation between a nidre shogeg versus a nidre ones, which is possibly by the nidre shogeg, there's less duress involved. In that there are mistakes that are made over here, but the mistakes are something that could have been prevented or with more care could have been taken care of. So that's why they're called shogeg, as opposed to the nidre ones, which are things that are completely out of your control under duress or things, unforeseen circumstances that you have no control over whatsoever. The truth is that the din is the same in both instances, which is that the nether does not take effect, likely because piv libo lo shavin. Most likely the reason that they don't take effect in these cases is because you need piv libo shavin, and that you don't have. Because you articulate something that is not necessarily true, bilibo. Because if he really searched carefully in his heart, he would know that he really did eat or he really did drink. And therefore, there's a failure there of piv libo shavin, and that's how most explain here why nidre shkagot don't get off the ground. So now he takes another possibility, she'ani ochel v'shani shoteh, that I will eat or I will drink, v'shachach, and then he forgets about it, v'achal v'shata, and then he eats and then he drinks. So now here, in a case where he premises the trigger of the nether by eating or drinking, that means that this nether will go into effect if I do eat. This nether will go into effect if I do drink. Then he goes on in later time, he eats or he drinks, but he forgets about the nether at the time that he's eating or drinking. The Ran tells us over here, and we saw this earlier in the Ran before, at the time that you're effectuating the nether, you have to have in mind that that's what you're doing, that you're triggering the nether. Because the nether does not take effect from the time that you articulated it. It only takes effect when you trigger the nether. And what the Ran says is that at that point of the trigger, which effectuates the nether to come into effect, you have to be conscious of the fact that piv libo shavim at that time. So the only way that happens is if you remember the nether and then you eat. You remember the nether and then you drink and then you trigger the nether. But if you simply eat and drink without being aware or conscious of that nether, then it won't take effect. And that's equivalent to nidre shkagot. That's the other type of nidre shogeg. All right. Konam ishti nenet li, sheganvat kisi v'shiktad bini. The person takes a nether that his wife will not get enough from him, because she stole my wallet, or because she hit my child. And as Tosfo points out over here, Perishri, Mairi, Delo Mishubada, has to be a case where he's not encumbered to his wife, and that's why he's able to take this nether hana'ah from her. V'noda shelo ikto, v'noda shelo ganva. And then we find out the information that she really didn't hit the child, or she didn't steal the wallet. And therefore, the nether is a nether shogeg. Now over here, we have a machloket. This was quoted earlier in the Gemara back on Chav Bet. And over there, there's a major machloket Rishonim about this. Does he have to actually articulate the fact that ganva or hikta bini? Does he have to articulate that that's why he's taking the nether? Or the context of the situation makes it apparent that he did take this nether, even though he was not mifaresh, that he's taking the nether specifically premised on this information. But now, in our Mishnah, when it says, nodash lo ikatov, nodash lo ganva, that's why it's automatically unwound that you don't need Shelat Chacham. Back on Gemara on Daf Chav Bet Amud Aleph, there we were looking for a case where he does need a petach from the Chacham, and that's why the Rishonim over there are dealing with whether the Girsa over there includes this information in Vinodah, or doesn't include this information, or he finds out that it's actually true, how does the Petach Neder work over there? Because if he clearly stated it, or it's implicit in his words, and then we find out that it's not true, our Mishnah deems it as Nidreish Gagot, then you don't even need a Terat Nedarim in that case. Whereas the Gemara in Chav Bet is saying that you do need Sheilat Chacham, and that's why the Rishonim, the Rashba over there, were pressured to figure out what's the scenario in which you would need Hatarat Nedarim. Is it a case where he finds out that it was true? Is it a case where he's Mamid Devarav, he says, even so, even when I find out it wasn't true, I still want the Neder to be in effect? And that's why he needs a Sheilat Chacham over there. The Baal Yatosef would say, Ein Lefaresh Shipiresh. You don't have to say here that he actually said, Im Ganvad Kiso, Chenim Ketad Bino, Dim Kem Shita Dolochal Neder. Because if he states that, then it's clear that the Neder doesn't take effect. Because he articulated the condition, and the condition didn't happen. So there are one or two ways to solve that problem. The way the Baal Yatosfot solved that problem is, they said that he did not articulate it. So since he didn't articulate it, it's an assumption of the context. And therefore, when he finds out the information, we say that that is sufficient grounds to unwind the Neder, because it's clear the only reason he took the Neder is because of that assumption of information, or what he thought was information, even though he did not articulate it. And therefore the Neder goes away when we find out the information. Whereas the Ran says over here that if he does not articulate the reason for the Neder, it would take effect. Now he might be able to get a Petach the Neder, because based on that fact that he had that in mind, but if he doesn't articulate it, it's not considered to be a Nidre Shogeg. Versus the upcoming case that we'll see in the Mishnah, where he says that it's completely Nidre Shogeg, even though he doesn't articulate the fact that he didn't intend for the Neder to take effect on these individuals, because there's a mistake in the effectuation of the Neder itself, because he had misinformation when he took the Neder. Zoran says here, V'chol sheyesh b'ikar neder ta'ut, ein piv libo shavim. There's a mistake at the moment that he's taking the Neder, then there's a lacking of piv libo shavim, u'batel me'atzmo. And therefore the Neder unwinds by itself. That's why he has to articulate that Shaganvad Kisi. Dilo, because if he doesn't say that, even though that's what he had in mind, he intended to take a Neder against his wife. There's nothing in the Neder itself, there's no information, there's nothing that he's saying that is untrue. He wanted to be Oser, his wife, Behana. He might have had in mind that it had to do with certain things, but his clear intent is to be Oser, his wife, Behana. And therefore it takes effect. But in the case coming up in the Mishnah, where he mistakenly assumed it was a person that it wasn't, over there the Ikar Neder fails, because he didn't want to take a Neder on his father or his brother. And therefore it's Batel Miatzmo, and you don't need a Sheilat Chacham. Alright. Ra'u Tano Chlin Teinim. He saw them eating figs from his field. V'mar Eri Aleichem Kurban. He makes them Asur Ba'ana'ah. These people are taking figs from his field without his permission. So he makes the figs Asurim Ba'ana'ah on them. V'nimtzu Aviv V'achiv. Ayu Imahem Achirim. And then he realizes that it's his father and his brother that are the ones taking from the fig tree, plus other people that are with them, guests that they brought along. Beit Shammai omim ein mutarim mamashim ha'em asurim. Beit Shammai says that the father and brother are excluded from the Neder, whereas the other parties that are there are governed by the Neder. Beit Hillel omim elu ve'elu mutarim, that they are both mutarim. Basically, the premise of Beit Hillel, as we'll see in the Gemara, is that Neder, shutar miksato, hutar kulo. If you unwind a portion of a Neder, the remainder of the Neder automatically unwinds or unbundles. You can't unbundle parts of a Neder and say that this part is true and this part is not true. Once you've taken a piece of the Neder out, then it's automatically that all the other pieces fall away. So over here, if the Neder is not applicable to his brother and his father, it also will not be applicable to the other individuals that are there. And now the Gemara begins. Tana, Keshem Shnidre Shkagot Mutarim, Kach Shvot Shkagot Mutarot. So just like a Neder Bishkagah is Mutar, so too a Shvuah Bishkagah is Mutar. So again, if the Girsa in the previous Mishnah was Mutarot, then it would be similar in nature. And the Ran points out the same thing, which is by Vuadin Shvat Zruzim Shari. So too, the Gemara never brought that statement with regards to Nidre Ziruzim. But he says, just like Nidre Ziruzim are Mutarim, so are Shvot Ziruzim also Mutarim. And therefore we're saying that the Din of Shvuah is parallel to the Din of Neder, in at least all of these three instances so far. Now, the Gemara asks over here, Echidami Shvot Shkogot. Where would we find such a thing as a Shva Shkogot? As the Ran says, Lavda Memra Dolo Mashkinan Shvot Shkogot. It's not to say here that we can't find a Shva Bishogeg. That we find with, it's easy to find situations like that. But rather, they want to know, either you can say it this way, how far do we take this statement of Shvuah Shagogot? What's the most you can push the envelope in terms of the line is what's called Shvuah Shagogot? Or, it's asking, how do we find a Shvuah that's parallel to the Nidarim? In the Mishnah, like we were trying to do on yesterday's daf with regards to the Shvuah Havai, find me a Shvuah Havai that looks like the Neder Havai over here. What's the parallel scenario where you would say that a Shva that looks like this Neder is called a Shva Shgogot? So one of those two things, that's what the Gemara is asking over here. Now more generally, the problem is that when it comes to a Shva Bitui in the Torah, one brings a Kurban when Bishogeg, they either take or violate a Shva Bitui. So if you tell me over here that all Shva Shgogot are automatically Ois Shva, they're not a Shva, then how do you have a case in the Torah where you're going to bring a korban for a shvat shogeg? So what you have to assume there is that the case in the Torah is a case of omer mutar. I didn't know that there was a problem of shvot. Some sort of lack of information that makes it that he took the shvuah or that he violated the shvuah. But not over here, what we're seeing over here where there's a lack of piv v'libo shavim. Over here where he takes the neder or the shvuah and there's some dissonance between what he's saying and what he knows, or what he's saying and what he should have known. So that causes a problem where the Shvuah unwinds completely. But in a case where he meant to take the Shvuah, and Pivalibo Shavim, but he has a mistake in the halachic impression of what that means, that's the case where you have to bring a Korban in terms of the Korbanot that are mentioned in the Torah with regards to Shvuah Bitoy. So now the Gemara says, Echi Dami Shvuah Shkogot, Kugon Rav Kana Rav Asi. It's the story of Rav Kana Rav Asi. Adena Amar Shvuato Dahachi Amar Rav. I take a Shvuah that Rav definitely said it this way. But Adena Amar Shvuato Dahachi Amar Rav. The other one says, no, I take a Shvuah that Rav said it this way. Tuchol V'chai V'chad Adatid in Afshi Shaper Kemishtaba. Because in isolation, each one of them is taking a Shvuah that they believe is absolutely true. Now it's clear that one of them is wrong in this case. So in context of them both taking the Shvuah, one of them is clearly wrong. On the other hand, when they're taking the Shvuah, they believe the Shvuah that they're taking is completely true, and that the alternative is not there. And therefore, when they take the Shvuah, they really believe that they're taking the proper Shvuah. If they find out later that it was wrong, that is a Shvuah of Shigagaga, which is that at the time they're taking it, they thought that the information was correct, and that they knew that this was the case, and therefore they took the Shvuah. And similar to the neder, where he takes the neder that I didn't eat, or that I didn't drink, and then he finds out later, or remembers later that he did eat or he did drink. So it's over here, when they find out, one of them, that they're incorrect, or that they're wrong, then the shvua is considered to be a shvat shogeg, because they forgot. They literally forgot. At the time of taking the shvua, they believe what they're saying is true, but they didn't, I would say, delve deeply enough into their memories, or to their heart, to figure out that that wasn't the case, and then, that is why it is considered to be a shvua that is okay. So the Havamina would have been that this is not considered to be a Nidre Shogeg, because as opposed to the case in the Mishnah, where he says, Lo Achalti or Lo Shatiti, over there was only one person who had the information, that was him, and he took the shvua and he forgot about it. But over here, since the other party is arguing with him, he knows there's an alternative. He knows the possibility that he's wrong. So he would have thought over here, maybe in that case of Shvat Shogeg, That's not called a Shvat Shogeg. That would be called a Shvat Shav or Shvat Sheker. No, the answer is in the end that because in isolation, what he's thinking, he thinks he's absolutely right. That is called a Shvat Shogeg because the premise of the Shvuah was based on his thinking it was right. When he finds out that he was wrong, then the Shvuah is null and void like the Neder in the Mishnah. It's not autumn. We have a Mishnah over there. Potchim b'Shabbatot u'b'yomim tovim. That we use a petach the nether with Shabbat and Yom Tov. Berishuna ayu omrim utara yamim mutarim. In the beginning, they used to say that his nether is not effective for Shabbat and Yom Tov. B'shar kol yamim matzurim, but every other day would be asur. Ad Shabbat Rabbi Akiva v'li meid, until Rabbi Akiva comes along and teaches us nether shutar miksato hutar kulo. A nether who is unwound for a part of it, then the entire nether is unwound. So this is an interesting insertion here of the Gemara. The Gemara is clearly comparing the Mishnah further on to our Mishnah over here, which is that our Mishnah over here, the person takes a nether of sorts, and there's some sort of mistake in his understanding of what the circumstance was. He sees people eating the figs from the tree, and he mistakenly thought that they were all people stealing from his tree. So he takes the nether in the Mishnah. That nether happened to be on his father and his brother who were present there eating from the figs. So that he had a mistaken assumption. Similarly over here, a person says, I'm going to fast every day of the year. He's going to fast every day of the year. What about Shabbat v'Yom Tov? So that's what the Mishnah says. Potchim lo b'Shabbatot v'Yomim Tovim. We ask him really if he meant it for Shabbat and Yom Tov. Now, as everyone, all the Rishonim point out over here, the cases are not exactly parallel. Because by the case of the figs, there was no way he could have known that it was his father or his brother that were over there when he took the nether. Over here, when a person takes a nether, they know that the year includes Shabbat and Yom Tov. And that's why there's a difference in the outcome. In the case by the father and the brother, it's automatically no. Because it's clear that he didn't have them in mind or he didn't intend for them. On the other hand, by the case of Shabbat and Yom Tov, he has to get a petach, the nether. He has to go to the Chacham to get the Hatarat Nedarim, because the nether did take effect. He should have known about Shabbat Yom Tov. But that also does present an issue, which is, how are you putchim Shabbat Yom Tov if he's supposed to know about them? So, the Gemara and the Rishonim deal with the different possibilities and permutations of what you could say over here. I mean, did you really understand that fasting on Shabbat Yom Tov is improper? Did you understand that that would be a pekiyah on the kavod of Shabbat Yom Tov? Did you take into consideration the fact that it was Shabbat Yom Tov? You could phrase it in different ways, that the guy might be latently aware of the fact that there's Shabbat Yom Tov, but not actively aware, and therefore it can be used as a petach, even though the guy should have known or does know that a year includes Shabbat and Yom Tov. So that's the first thing. So it's not an exact parallel to our Mishnah. The second thing, what it seems that the Gemara brought this Mishnah for, is the comment of Rabbi Akiva on the Mishnah, which is that, and neder shehutar miktzato hutar kulo, meaning that the Gemara now assumes that that's the machlok between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai in our Mishnah. That the position of Beit Hillel is similar to this position of Rabbi Akiva, and Beit Shammai is similar to the position of the Rabbanan. Now that's difficult and also interesting from the perspective of the fact that if Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai argued about this, why did the Chachamim not know about it? Then why is Rabbi Akiva introducing it? So you could always answer that it was Machlok Beit Hillel and Shammai, it was forgotten, and Rabbi Akiva brings back that halacha. That's a possibility. The other problem that you have is now Rabbi Akiva is aligning with Beit Hillel and the Rabbanan are aligning with Beit Shammai. And why would they do such a thing? So you could argue, and that's a possibility, that the Rabbanan believe that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are not arguing about that point. They don't think that they're arguing about whether it's Hutar Miksato or Hutar Kulo. And therefore they think Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel agree on that point, that it wouldn't work. And that their machloket is about something else. That's what the Rabbanan feel. Rabbi Akiva thinks, no, that is the machloket between Beit Hillel and Shammai, and he's aligning himself with Beit Hillel. Or obviously you could explain that the machloket Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai in our Mishnah is not really about Hutar Neder v'miksato Hutar Kulo, but rather that it's a Nidrei Shogeg or Nidrei Taot, and that's what's causing the Heter in our Mishnah. But you'll have to explain it one of those ways to make it actually possible to understand why Rabbi Akiva and the Chachamim are having an argument that was already had by Beit Hillel Beit Shammai in our Mishnah. But it's clear that the Gemara connects between the two and says that the reasoning behind Beit Hillel and our Mishnah is that Hutar Miksato, Hutar Kulo. So now Amar Rabbah. So now Rabbah says, the Kuli Amma, everybody agrees. Kohecha Damar, Ili Uhaiti Yodeya Sha'aba Benechem. Had I known my father was amongst you, Iti Omer Kuchem Asurim Chutz Mi'abo, that all of you are Asurim except for my father. The Kulon Asurim, Vaviv Mutar. Then Enoch and Ami, they're all Asurim, and his father is Mutar. Lo Nechluku, where is the Machloket? El Beomer. Ilu Haiti Yodea Sha'aba Benechem. Had I known my father was amongst you, Haiti Omer, I would have said, Ploni Uploni Asurim, so and so is Asur, Baba Mutar, and my father is Mutar. So here we're going to stop here with Rabbah's interpretation. Tomorrow we'll look at Rabbah's interpretation, which is slightly different or nuanced from Rabbah's interpretation, but what Rabbah suggests over here is, how much did the nether change? Nether took a nether, was with a Lashon Kolel, with a Lashon that incorporated everybody that was there, which says, Kulchem Asurim. All of you are Asur Be'ana. So he incorporated everybody. Then after the fact, he comes back and he says, had I known my father was there, I would have said, Kuchem Asurim, Chutz Me'aba. So in that case, what Rabba suggests is that everybody agrees that the nether stays intact. Because he basically did not change the nether. He said, Kuchem Asurim in the beginning. And he continues to say, Kuchem Asurim. Continues to say that afterwards. He just gives us that interpretation that it means Chutz Me'aba. But the nether, the Lashon HaNeder in whole, is still intact. But if he comes to us and says, listen, had I known my father was there, I would have said so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so are Surim, but my father is Mutar. In that case, not only is he taking his father out of the nether, but now he's also changing the way that he would have formulated the nether. He's going from a nether kolel to a nether of pirut, of detail. And that causes a breach of the nether, or a breach of the intent of the nether. And therefore we're going to say that hutar miksato, hutar kulo. Which is interesting. So what Rabba suggests over here is that when he segregates his father out of the nether, that's not hutar miksato. That's not saying that a miksa of the nether is not intact. Because basically he said kuchem asurim, and he meant kuchem asurim. Just, he never intended for his father to be incorporated under Kulchem Asurim. So his father being taken out of the Kulchem Asurim is not really a Hutar Miksato, it's rather that it was not intended ever to be for his father. So if he holds that language intact, then his father being excluded is just a natural outcome of the fact that he wouldn't have incorporated his father in Kulchem Asurim, but Kulchem Asurim stays intact, and therefore the nether is still in effect. But if he says it this way, which is that I would have never said the nether in this manner had I known it was my father, because then I would have said, you and you and you and you are Asurim, and my father is Mutar. Then he's clearly saying that he is breaking the nether up and saying that the language that he used would have incorporated his father. And therefore, when he takes his father out, then it's a nether shutar miksato, therefore it's a hutar kulo. So Rabba says, how much the nether stays intact after the fact will matter as to whether this is considered to be Hutar Miksato or not Hutar Miksato. The exclusion of his father, is it because simply his father is not included in this type of language? Or is it because if he used this language, his father would have been included, and therefore now he's unwinding the nether, and he's segregating the nether between his father and the other parties? And that would cause an unwinding of the nether, and then it would be subject to the machlokes between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, whether Hutar Miksato is Hutar Kulo. As the Rosh says over here, Umitchila asar aleihem b'lashon kuchem, kevin shechliv devarav, since he changes the wording, hora koach haneder, that takes down the effectiveness or the power of the neder, and that's why we can now say, since utar miksato, utar kulo. As the Ran says over here, kevin da'ocha ikatarte, over here you have two things to the deficit. Chalat ikatot gamur, the gabi ha'ab, there's a full-fledged mistake with regards to the father. And the other parties, Gamkin Yishtau Pilashon. There's a mistake in the language. So the compounding of those two issues is what makes it into a Neder Taot. But if it was simply just the mistake with his father, that wouldn't be sufficient to deem it a Neder Taot. Tosafot makes the point that it has nothing to do with Kolel or Piruta Neder. And if it was in the reverse, it would be the same thing. If he took the Neder originally, it'd be Pirut. And then he changed it later on to Kolel, it would have the same effect as saying that Hutar Miksato Hutar Kulo. But if he said Pirut up front, and then he continued to say Pirut, that would be the same thing as saying that Kolel and Kolel afterwards, that there's no change in Lashon and Neder, and the Neder would stay intact. So according to the Balei HaTosafot, and you see it in the Rosh as well, it's all focused on the language itself. As long as you maintain the original language, then it's as if the power of the Neder is still in effect, and we don't say Hutar Miksato. On the other hand, if you think that it's unique to the Lashon Kolel, and if you use Lashon Pirut, it wouldn't have worked, then you would have to explain along the lines that we did, which is that the Lashon Kolel, when you say Kuchem Asurim, clearly he means everyone besides his father. And therefore the Lashon Kolel can be maintained after the fact. And if he switches to Lashon Pirut, that means that no, that in Kuchem Asurim he would have included his father. But if you started out with the Lashon of Pirut, there it's clear that when he excludes his father, that he's taking out the nether because he enumerated each individual in the nether. And therefore, if he said, Pirut, 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 and then he wants to switch it afterwards, even if he just takes out his father, that already is a substantial change in the nether because he's taking out a piece of the nether which was the fact that it specified his father to be Asur. And therefore it would not be true in the reverse, unlike what the Balei HaTosafot said. So that's the Shita of Rabbah. Okay, we're going to stop here on the last line of Chaf Hei Amud Bet, and tomorrow we'll continue Rabbah's Shita with regards to this Machloket.